Retina Rounds podcast number 9. For our latest podcast, Retina Rounds is honored and excited to welcome Dr. David Brown. Dr. Brown built one of the premier private practices and clinical research centers in the world at Retina Consultants of Houston, and his practice has served as a model for how to maintain high quality and ethical standards when conducting clinical research. Beyond his numerous scientific contributions in retina, Dr. Brown has also been a pioneer in the business of retina, having led groups of top-tier retina practices around the country to form Retina Consultants of America. Dr. Brown talks about his group's considerations when they decided to partner with private equity, how this has facilitated their ability to raise the level of care in communities around the country, and the impact that private equity has had on the recruitment of the best and brightest young retina doctors. Let's check it out.
Well, welcome everybody to our Giants in Retina series for Retina Rounds. It's a great privilege to have Dave Brown with us today from Retinal Consultants of Texas, where preserving vision is their mission. And Dave is probably one of the most innovative retina docs in the United States, if not the world. And David, it's a real pleasure to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Dave, tell us about your journey to deciding you were going into retina. How did you decide you were going to be a doctor and then come to retina?
Yeah, so I came from a blue-collar town, Ship Chandler, Texas. And if you're the top of your class from kindergarten on, you're either going to be a lawyer or a doctor because everybody else works in a plant. And for whatever reason, I chose doctor. And that path keeps going because they keep patting you on the back and saying, oh, you're going to make a great doctor before you even know what a doctor does, right? And then I live in Houston, Texas, where the giants of cardiovascular surgery all were. Michael DeBakey, Denton Cooley. And so the coolest thing in medicine when I was in high school was cardiovascular surgery. And that's what I wanted to do. So I decided it was going to take a 7-year cardiovascular surgery fellowship. So I better get out of college really early because I'm going to be old by the time I get out of this vascular surgery fellowship. So I went to Houston Baptist, which became Houston Christian, because they got everybody into med school. And I basically got accepted to med school after 2 years of college. I finished, but I went through really quick to get to med school quick. In the meantime, I was able to become a summer student for Denton Cooley, who is one of the most famous retina, most famous heart surgeons in the world. He did the first artificial heart. He did a lot of the initial bypass and valve work. And I wanted to be a heart surgeon, and that was my whole goal. So I applied to Baylor and Duke Med School because they had the best cardiovascular surgeries. And then I sort of figured out that cardiovascular surgery was going away, and it's because cardiology, invasive cardiology, was just happening. Funny story, I was with Denton Cooley when this guy Grunzig, who was the chair at Emory that invented angioplasty, I was with Denton as an 18-year-old sewing up the legs. That's what I did. I'd sew up the legs of the bypasses, and hear him, you know, talk and be a hero. And I'm with him when Grunzig passed away and the next morning. And they say, did you hear Grunzig passed away? And he goes, God hates them damn angioplasters, and he's starting at the top. So, and you can see that, like, the best cardiovascular surgery fellows were having a hard time getting a job, right? They were moving to Tyler, Texas, and doing vein accesses for dialysis and stuff. So fortunately, about the same time I learned about retina, I actually learned about it from Denton Cooley. Denton Cooley, I'm operating with him on a heart transplant in the middle of the night. And he looks at me and he goes, you need to be a retina surgeon. And I didn't know a retina surgeon from a rectal surgeon. I'm an 18-year-old undergrad, right? I go, Dr. Cooley, what are you talking about? And he goes, Alice McPherson made more money than me this year, and she's at home sleeping right now. So anyway, that's not when I decided to be a retina surgeon, but certainly later on in med school, I started looking at other fields. I looked at hand surgery. I looked at neurosurgery, pediatric surgery. I about died in a pediatric OR with the temperatures of 110 degrees or whatever they are. But early on, decided I wanted to be a retina surgeon. And so I had a guy, my neuroanatomy TA at Baylor was this super smart guy named Ed Stone. And Ed Stone convinced me that I ought to do ophthalmology and I ought to do retina and I ought to come to Iowa. And I never thought I would do that. And it worked out okay. So,
and that's where you went.
That's where I went. I wanted to be a chair. I wanted to be an academic chair. And you either went to Willmar or Mass Eye and Ear or you went to Iowa. You know, there were chairs from other places, certainly the Ryan, you know, through USC and UCLA like you guys. And I interviewed at all those places. In Willmar, nobody was operating or they were sending you to India at that time. Now it's way better. Mass Eye and Ear, you know, Klaus Dolman wanted me to do an extra 20 years as a PhD, like everybody, right? And Iowa, I went there first thinking I'd never go to Iowa, but I kept coming back to it and ranked it and fortunately got in there. So it worked
out.
And
who was your chair and mentor there besides Ed? Who was the chair there? Was it Tom?
Yeah, so Tom was there, but also Fred Blody was back, right?
Right.
And so Fred Blody was this amazing giant, a true giant. Like he was the head of the American College of Surgeons as a ophthalmic pathologist, right? And Fred Blody was this guy that spoke seven languages. And when he retired, when he stepped down as chair at Iowa, he was such a giant, he realized, boy, I need to go away or I'm going to overshadow the next chair. So we went and he founded King Fahd Eye Hospital, Faisal Eye Hospital, you know, the big one in Saudi Arabia. And then he came back and he did pathology at Iowa and worked a couple days a week. And like the first day I come back as a resident, Blody has memorized everybody's bios. And I don't know this guy from Adam. I sort of know him because he's famous. And he comes up to me as Dr. Brown. Welcome to Iowa. And it memorized my bio, right? I mean, the guy was amazing. Tom was the chair and smart and more introverted, certainly more of a nerd. But, you know, the people there were amazing in terms of Stan Thompson, Soan Hayray in medical retina and uveitis. You had, you know, in retina, you had Chris Blody was there before he left. You had Culver Bolt, you had Alan Kimura as a junior faculty, you had really great training, Jose Polito before he went to Wisconsin and then Mayo. And it was a great experience.
Spectacular. And where did you decide to take your fellowship and how did you decide?
Yep. So at the time I was a resident in Iowa and Iowa has amazing programs. You operate a lot. You get a lot of supervised surgery, but also it gets dark like at 4 in the afternoon. And I didn't have cable TV, so we had like four kids. And as it, the path of least resistance was to stay at Iowa, I interviewed at Madison. I'm sorry, yeah, the 1 year program in Wisconsin and I interviewed at Bascom, but then I decided to stay at Iowa, partly to continue. I've had three nice Templar grants, you know, found about half the Stickler genes at the time. Was doing a bunch of work with Ed Stone and really wanted to continue that. So did that while doing the medical and retina surgical fellowship.
Well, that's the truth of it, right? I mean, the opportunity to work with Ed and to be achieving at that level at that point in your career is really a tough thing to, it's that golden handcuff. How do you get out of that?
Absolutely. And, you know, basically thinking I'm going to be a chair, I really, you know, I was right at the stage where I was, you know, could have got an R05, you know, had multiple publications off, you know, funded research. And so, you know, the ability to do that anywhere else, Bascom Palmer is a fantastic program, but they don't have anything like that in terms of, at the time, in terms of bench research or, and the ability to do something like molecular genetics where you can operate all day and the gels are running themselves, right? And also it's great for my family. Iowa City is an amazing place. you know, living on a college campus, walking to work. It's freezing cold, but it was a great experience. Great training, great people. Iowa City's, a lot of people don't know the story of the hospital. The story of the hospital was Iowa is a state kind of like Sweden or Norway. It's a very homogeneous population, and they take care of their own population, which is a predominantly white agrarian people. And in the early 1920s, they realized that we have all these great little hospitals all over the state, but no super tertiary care. There's no Mayo Clinic. There's no, University of Chicago or whatever. And so what they decided to do was to build a hospital in Iowa City and then get a fleet of Model Ts and Model As or whatever. And if you got sick or you had complicated stuff, they sent you. So what ended up happening is they built a top five program in ENT and an OB-GYN and an ophthalmology and all these super specialties, because you had the tertiary care of this massive state with basically a funded system. So in Iowa, the charity patients and the richest guy in the state could be two beds apart. And they looked the same. One was worth a lot more money, but it was actually a really neat place to train in terms of both the teaching and the ability to take care of an indigent population and operate a lot, but still have the resources of of a big city. So.
Very exciting. And so, as you were coming out of fellowship, how did you make? Where did you go first, and what was your decision tree like? You had a big family already. You were very accomplished, and you probably could have gone anywhere. So how did you choose and where did you go?
You would think so. At the time, and you would remember this, not many people younger than us do, but there was a corporatization of medicine. And there were a bunch of ophthalmology programs being bought up by what was the name of it? It just went blank. Anyway, the stock exchange was basically owned a bunch of multi-specialty practices. At the same time, HillaryCare was being purported as it's going to take over all of medicine. So the academic programs were all worried that they were going to lose their funding. They weren't going to have patients. And so, like I said, I wanted to be an academic program. And I wrote letters, everybody wrote for me. The only decent job offer I had was at Vanderbilt, and I was set to go. I was going to be the only retina surgeon. I was going to be able to have a lab, and I was going to be the retina surgeon for Don Gass, because Don Gass was leaving Miami and retiring in Nashville. And I was excited. We looked at houses, and long story short of it is the chair at the time came to me and said, we've got a great offer for you, but it's a non-tenure track position. And I go, what do you mean? I've got, I'm going to have an R05. I want to be a chairman. And he goes, we need you to make us money. And I said, I'm going to make you money. I like to operate. He goes, well, what about your lab day? What will happen if there's a detachment? I said, the gels run themselves. I can, this will all be fine, and we can never get past that. And if I was going to be non-tenure track, why would I go to a university position? And so at that point, I decided to make my wife happy. I'm a fifth generation Texan. She's from Houston as well. And I interviewed at Texas Retina in Dallas and Calmine in San Antonio and several groups in Houston. Decided to move to Houston and to build my own research practice. And so built a research practice within a surgical retina group. That was interesting. We blinded a bunch of people and we made people sick with alpha interferon. And we did all these crummy PDT trials and VIP and VIM, and then got really lucky to be, on the ground stage of the anti-VEGF trials with what we called RUFAB V2 at the time, which became ranibizumab, which became Lucentis.
And you were one of the great enrolling sites from the get-go. I remember when we first got you involved in those, and you guys just took off. Who were the surgeons that you joined?
There was a guy, Van Teeters, who was he trained at Moorfields, and he was basically the the alternative to Alice McPherson in Houston, and was a very good surgeon. He had Mike Hines with him, who was another well-trained, good surgeon. And I bought them out 2 years later, and then took on Tian Wong, who is fantastic. And then we've grown subsequently to where we are. So
how many trials at your peak before the modern era, just when it was the one practice, how many trials at your peak were you guys enrolling in?
Kind of like white cells in a VA urine, too numerous to count, right? You know, we would have, you know, it actually was, number of trials is sort of a misnomer, because you end up having a lot of phase ones that may or may not work that are pretty high risk that you may not enroll a bunch in, right? If you find something that's a unique niche, like the anti-VEGFs or a better anti-VEGF or a longer acting VEGF, where it's ethical to recruit outside of your practice, and then you could have one trial that's half of your whole research, right? You know, or one program.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because you guys actually did a great job, not only of enrolling volume, which is important, but it's not nearly as important as enrolling quality. And you did a great job of, you did a great job and still do a great job, and we'll come to this, of finding the patients, ethically offering them to come into the trial. You know, we don't know if we're going to make you better or worse. You can do this if you want to. We think this is biologically plausible, a good informed consent. But you did a really, and continue to do a really stellar job of performance. You've got quality data, and that doesn't come out. It's garbage in, garbage out, and it's high quality in, high quality out. So I'm really driving it. What's the secret sauce? You're a super high volume practice. You've got a lot of doctors. You've obviously, and we'll come to what you look for in your partners. This is all pre-RCA, but you talk to me about that, like your quality control. You are obviously are one of the smart guys. Everybody's smart in our field, but you're also one of the really high integrity guys. And so your casual demeanor is one thing, like mine, but you do a great job of ethical recruiting and ethical performance of the trials. Speak to me about the quality processes that you instituted. You learned some lessons and made some mistakes early, like we all did. What were the ones that you learned, and what became your North Star for research?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, just like you tell anybody you train or you know, the first thing is to treat the patient the way you'd treat your family. And if you think the trial's not working, or you think there are better options for them, tell them that they should, you know, you first go to the sponsors and say, hey, this, something's not working. Can we change the retreatment criteria? Can we do this or that? But your first responsibility is to the patient. Your second responsibility is to the science. And the science is something that a lot of people don't quite get. In other words, there's all kinds of things they make you do in a trial, and some of them make no sense and probably don't have anything to do with the outcomes. But you still have to be diligent and consistent with that science. In other words, I had a great coordinator, and he was a PhD, and he was in his postdoc, but taking a year off, and he was great with patients, and it was IST I was doing, an investigator sponsored trial, and I'm going, and one of the things that the sponsor wanted was a temperature at every visit, right? And it's kind of stupid. I mean, unless you think they're septic, like, why would you really care, and is it going to change? But it was a little mouse strip, and everybody's temperature in the whole trial was 98.2 or something. Like, he didn't even lie and say it was 98.6. Like, he didn't say normal every time. He said one number every time. And I went to him and I said, look, this can't be that every time you put a strip in the mouth, it's 98.2. And he basically fessed up that, you know, that's not important. And, you know, I just fudged that. And so you got to fire that guy, even though he's great. Like, you can't fudge one thing in your science and expect me to trust anything else. You know, when we started, trials didn't make any money. You probably lost money if you did it right. And you still lose money on trials if you do some of them right, right? There are a lot of groups now that go in and recruit phase threes, and they think, boy, this is a lot of money per subject per year. But you got to have the training, you got to have the individual invest. You know, you can make money on trials, don't get me wrong. And we do. But that is not the reason to go into trials. The reason to go into trials is you're truly trying to fight blindness. You're truly interested in helping patients, and you're truly interested in moving the science forward. You know, what I would encourage other people, you know, remember as an investigator that it is truly you're in charge of the trial. It is you determining causality. In other words, when if you randomize, and if you randomize to two different drugs, and one of them, you know, you have a patient with a heart attack, and you know that the patient got the experimental drug, and you say, well, it couldn't be related because there's no way an anti-VEGF in the eye causes this or whatever. And you say there's no way it could be related, then how do you know? Like, what if there is a 0.5% incidence of gallbladder cancer or whatever? So you assume that everything is caused by the drug. And what happens now is you have all these companies that are either pre-public or they're venture cap funded, and they're all trying to get incredible data out of a phase one, which is really hard, right? You're really trying to get safety data. You're trying to figure out your dose, but they're trying to see efficacy data, and they're trying to make it look as safe as mother's milk. And you say, boy, I think that this, you know, peripheral wipeout of the RPE, that's probably related to your drug. And they put a lot of pressure on my junior investigators and others. No, that you can't say that, right? You say it's unrelated. If you think it's possibly related at all, the FDA thinks everything could be related, right? I mean, be honest. It's your, you know, if the randomization gods work out right, there'll be the same number of gallbladder cancers in the control arm as there are in the treatment arm. So a lot of people don't realize that you're the boss, not the drug company, and that you can stand up to them. And I've been fired a bunch. I was fired by Alcon for antiquartate when I told them the phase two data didn't really look like it worked.
I remember it well, and Allergan as well.
Yep, Allergan as well with the DARPin. They wanted to, I mean, but it's, and I'm not always right. Like, I didn't think the AREDS trial would work. I mean, vitamins, we did that trial to prove that vitamins wouldn't work, right? Sure enough, you know, it 25% risk reduction. I think it's real. Same thing with complement. You know, I didn't really see why anti-complement would work for GA, right? There's no real genetic markers that go that way. And it doesn't work, you know, like penicillin for syphilis, but, you know, it's more like PDT. It decreases your chance of a worse outcome.
Well, it's an interesting battle we fight in our own minds as investigators when we're not expert enough to grasp the biologic plausibility and whether or not you're working with a good partner and there's a process that one goes through as an investigator, feeling out these sponsors. So before the advent of RCA, how many people did you have in your practice? How many docs and how many people on your research side?
Yeah, so we were 11 partners in Houston, and we were financially doing very well. Research-wise, we were the top site in the world. Had recruited some really impressive talent: Charlie Wyckoff, James Major, Amy Scheffler, you know, some superstars, and we were fine. And really didn't think that we would ever look at private equity. And then our friends in New Jersey Retina sold to Quad C. And we were getting calls all the time from, and not calls, you know, blanket emails, you know, would you should talk to us about potentially marketing your practice. And you know, really thought that why would we ever do that? We're happy, we control our own destiny. But when Printer and Steve Madreporla and you know Dan Roth and other, our good friends, you know, and those groups sold, you know, the thought was maybe we need to look at this and maybe we need to do more diligence before we say this is not something we want to do.
Now, were you the managing partner at that time?
We didn't, you know, like most retina groups, we didn't, quote, have a managing partner. You know, it's kind of like herding cats. You kind of manage by consensus. You know, I ran all the research, but really we tried to get a consensus where everybody believed that what we're going to do is the right thing to do, right? So we officially didn't have a managing partner. But what we did was we created a what we called a PE committee, and we took young guys, middle guys, and old guys. I was essentially the old guy then, and Matt Benz, Charlie Wyckoff, Ankur Shah, and our administrator. And if you're interested in recapitalizing your partner, the most important thing you get is an investment banker. And your investment banker is like your real estate agent. They really don't make much money unless you sell. But what you want to make sure is that they're really in your best interest. In other words, we did this process thinking we would never sell. So we interviewed 17 investment bankers, and that's a lot. And these interviews are an hour, hour and a half, and then you fly them in and talk to them for a couple hours because you're really going to work with this person to figure out, is this a good fit for your practice, how to market your practice, or how to put your practice in the best light. And when I came to Houston in 95, I told you I wanted to build a research clinic. I had a business plan, and the business plan was pretty easy. There were, at the time, about 17 retina docs in the Houston area, and all the groups were within three blocks of each other, right? Right in the Texas Medical Center. They were Methodist St. Louis.
So,
right?
David, just for those of us who are in our audience who are listening from around the world, just describe the Houston metro area. Most people don't realize that Houston is a very big city.
Yeah, Houston's about 9 million metro now. Houston has the biggest medical center in the world with MD Anderson, the top-ranked cancer institute. It's got Baylor College of Medicine. It's got University of Texas. It's got Methodist Hospital, which is probably the richest hospital in the world. It's got Memorial Hermann. So the Texas Medical Center complex is the biggest medical complex in the world. It's where
it's a city. It's a city.
It's a city, right? Yeah. And so retina surgery was so niche at the time, people would come from Louisiana or Arkansas, just like they went there for cancer care, just like they went there for heart care, right? They went to Denton Cooley, they went to Michael DeBakey.
I just want to know, David, did you have your own elevator like Dr. DeBakey did?
I parked in the same garage, so I went up his elevator.
There you go. So Texas, Houston's a big city, and yeah. And the medical complex is a city unto itself, and you draw from a lot of states, and you yeah. had 11 docs, and you interviewed 17 investment bankers. How did you land on your banker? What were you looking for in the investment banker? Like, they were all smart and they were all cagey. So was it integrity? Was it backslap? Good old boy. What were you looking for?
I think it was pure integrity and somebody that would be thoughtful in helping us figure out how would we expand our business plan. In other words, I think it'd be different if I knew I was going to sell and I knew who I was going to sell to or had a couple of options, right? We went into it thinking we weren't going to sell.
Right.
So the business plan in 2005, in 1995, when I came to Houston, was I was going to take world-class care and world-class equipment and put it in North Houston and West Houston and South Houston and choke off everybody else. And at the same time, do world-class research, which at the time was predominantly only done in universities and a few practices like David Boyer and Jeff Heyer, right? And so our business plan was to do what we'd done in Houston to take over a market by providing that access to care to patients where they live and to expand from Retina Consultants of Houston to Retina Consultants of Texas. In other words, to give the ability to do trials and research and negotiate contract with payers and with drug companies to San Antonio and Dallas and Houston and Austin, and see if that worked. And then if that worked, sell it and then go to Retina Consultants of America. And the goal was not to make money, but was to help more patients, to enlarge research. Yeah.
That's the key point. I'm sorry for interrupting, but that's the key point. You were not financially driven. You were driven by improving quality of care, democratizing care, raising the level for everybody that you came across. And that's important for our listeners to understand. And so who did you end up selling to?
Well, so the sort of 5-minute pitch I just told you of our business plan, or maybe it was 30 seconds. I told our banker, we used Wyatt Ritchie at Cain Brothers, who's an investment banker that does only healthcare. And the way most of these things work is they do an analysis of you, and they make a nice, beautiful brochure called a confidential information memorandum. And the dirty secret is none of them are confidential. Once they're out there, everybody knows everything about you. And I didn't really want to do a black box with a SIM. Not that I was worried about it. I just didn't think I would ever sell. And so I told Wyatt that our plan's going to be, I only want you to pitch us to funds of $1 billion or more of private equity companies that only do healthcare. I didn't want to do ones that had washers and dryers and healthcare and animal stuff, right? And the other critical piece of our business plan was that we really thought that all retina is the way to go because that's what we know. And, you know, if you're a retina tertiary care doctor, you get business from optometrists, from ophthalmologists, from general ophthalmology groups. And the idea of going to a vertically integrated system where I'm trying to buy my biggest referring entities to lock them in never made sense. At the time, I had 2,000 referring entities. If I bought my top 10, I would have pissed off 1,990. And that top 10 was only 8% of my business. The other problem I had with it is antitrust laws. You can't take over a third of a market. I already had more than a third of the retina business. So I couldn't start buying up all these optometric and ophthalmology programs. So I said, we want to be all retina. And we want to do this research thing, and we want to, you know, only hire top quality. And Wyatt pitched that to 30 different firms, and 17 said, that'll never work. Fat chance. So of the 13 that were interested, we went to New York, the investment committee, and we speed dated 11 of them, hour and 45 minutes each, where I gave, instead of the 2-minute pitch, I gave the hour pitch and then 45 minutes of questions. So I'm pitching this to all these companies, again, thinking that we're probably not even going to do this. And one guy says, well, why would you wait and go from Retina Consultants to Houston to Texas and then see if it worked for 5 or 6 years and then go to Retina Consultants of America? Why wouldn't you just go straight away? And I go, well, that would be a lot of risk and a lot of capital. And he said, we have infinite capital for great ideas. And it turns out that he had already met and lined up Joel Perlman's group,
Sacramento.
And so he kind of got the picture that there are retina groups that could come together. And this January 30th, before the pandemic started, we merged the Long Island group, Sacramento group, our group, Retina Group of Florida, all together. And
so that's Halperin, Fastenberg, Thielander and Company out in Sacramento, which is, of course, not how Perlman refers to them, but that's okay. Yep. That's how I think of them. Those are actually amazing groups.
And Santa Barbara with the
right. So if you think of the contributions of Bob Avery, Dante, those guys, and the Macular Hole innovations that came out of Sacramento, Fastenberg and Company in Long Island, and Halperin and his group down in all of South Florida, which basically were the other alternative to Bascom Palmer, really a marquee group of innovators, super high quality delivery. And so tell us what happened next. So you merged those groups, you figured out a way they could buy your practice, that financial details are not important, but
Yeah, so it
you.
wasn't. Part of it wasn't necessarily buying the practice. We made it where the physicians own 40% of the equity, and we made it where physicians own 40% of the equity. And it turns out that the private equity company, Webster, only owns 16%. Like, the rest were passive aggressors. We had several Merrill Lynch funds, et cetera. And really, we let each group run itself the way they ran each other in terms of schedules and how
And
they took.
why was that important? Tell our listeners why that was important. I mean, I know why it was important, but tell our
Yeah,
listeners why that's important.
I think the most important thing a physician does is to take care of a patient in their lane and give them the advice that he would give his own family. And what I didn't want is any way a corporate structure was going to say, you got to do this differently, or you have to sell this many widgets, or you have to work Saturdays. You have to keep these doctors happy. They're the ones that have built what they have. They know their individual markets. To come in and micromanage absolutely makes no sense. We can do a great job of negotiating nationally on whatever. Lactated ringers or whatever. We can do a great job on trying to, it's not necessarily negotiating with Blue Cross or United, but when you're small, you can't even get an audience with them, right? They are so big to get just enough where you can meet the medical directors and work towards a common goal of helping patients. That's the kind of thing we can do really well. We can take what we did in Houston, which was standardized the teaching of refractionists and the ethics of consenting and the good clinical practice and harmonization of medical records. You can compartmentalize that and teach that around the country. But to go in and individually tell docs, here's how you ought to practice, I don't think would work. And I think that they would either not continue in that practice or it wouldn't be successful.
Well, that's an actually extremely germane point, and that is another way of synthesizing that is, at least from my perspective, these are highly evolved, super successful entities with really smart people that are in their own microclimates, if you like, Houston, Miami, Sacramento, Long Island, same but different in many ways. And it's one thing to take economies of scale on things like lactated ringers or contracts. It's another thing to tell doctors how to practice medicine or to how to deal with their referring docs. And it's very, very important. And I personally feel it's the secret of your success that you haven't done that. And so you took those four practices and realized that, hey, this is actually working. And it's actually fun, and we're actually raising. You guys got better in Texas. Sacramento got better. New York got better. Miami got better. South Florida. And then what did you do next? Because you entered this period of logarithmic growth, and tell us about that th thought process.
A couple things happened. One, when we were looking at retina groups around the country, we were really unique in that we were so research focused. Like 22% of our EBITDA, our earnings, was research, and the next highest group we knew of in the country was four or five, right? And so it wasn't that doctors didn't want to do research. It's just the ability to have the infrastructure and to build the infrastructure and maintain that in sort of the ebbs and flows of research cycles. So we consolidated everybody on one clinical trial software system. We made everybody consolidate to a way where we could audit and make sure that the processes were the same. In other words, what we wanted to do is we wanted to sell our research to sponsors as we're going to maintain this level of quality you've had in Texas. And certainly, they did great research in Sacramento, but on a much smaller scale. And to be able to do that and to grow that, and then to get Lloyd Clark in South Carolina, to be able to get the Minnesota group with David Williams and Rob Mitra and Sandeep Dev, those groups joined us pretty quickly thereafter. And the most fortuitous thing was nothing we did. It's just that before this, everybody thought that the patients were controlled by the general ophthalmologist or the optometrist. and that the retina guys were captive. But when the pandemic hit, all those practices shuttered their doors, didn't see any patients, while we put on our masks and fixed retinal detachments and continued to do research and continued to give injections, because it turns out that retina was, you know, retina was an essential service. And general ophthalmology or optometry is fantastic, but it's a commercial service, right? It's
well, more that's right. And David Park and Steve McLeod and I published from the IRIS database that showed exactly that. Even in the states that had mandatory shutdowns, retina kept going and people didn't lose vision. And it was a kudos to our colleagues and to us that we were able to do that. And so you leveraged the pandemic because you learned a lesson.
Yeah, and not only that, it was actually better, you know, when New York got shut down, right? I mean, Long Island got shut down. But we were able to keep the Long Island group going, even though, you know, that not necessarily just economically, but just support. Like if there was a shortage of masks somewhere, then we would find it somewhere and ship to another part of the country. You know, we really were stronger together. It's sort of it sounds flippant to say we're stronger together, but we really were, both in the pandemic and in research and in negotiating for contracts and to have the diversity of really smart people's ideas and to have a commonality that we're all part of a fraternity sorority has really been helpful.
So you've created your own mega system now. And so now you went from 5, 6, 7 practices that were great. I mean, sure, you got the Jack Wells and the Will Parks and all these really marquee practices around the country. And then it jumped again. And now how many are in it now?
So 40 groups, 330 retina docs. We were worried about recruitment early on, you know, and there was troubles with recruitment early on. People thought.
So let's just clarify that. By recruitment, you don't mean recruiting practices. You mean recruiting doctors into the practices.
Yeah, the lifeblood of practices is to recruit new, great, well-trained doctors. As you know, you come from a top training program. There aren't many, right? I mean, there's a lot of programs out there that have either small numbers of surgical procedures or large numbers with no supervision. You know, to have truly great programs where you get volume and supervision, it's really tough. And to get those high quality doctors is the reason you can continue to grow and you can continue to make contributions and change our fight against blindness. And so we were worried we weren't going to be able to get them. And we've been successful at getting the top talent.
So let's talk about that, because certainly there was a period of time there where a lot of the top fellow graduates were coming out and saying, I'm either going to academia or I'm not going to private equity. And then they would join a small practice, small, maybe 2 to 4 docs, and they would be in this partnership track, and they'd be 2 to 3 years into a 4 or 5 year partnership track, and then they'd get acquired, and it would be up to that practice how they treated the docs. And some associates got treated well, and some perceived that their value was up on Cloud 9 when really it was on Cloud 3, and they were going to do fantastic anyway, but they were unhappy. And I can think of a number of my fellows graduates that had that happen with your group who were unhappy, but boy, they're happy now. And that's certainly not the way our fellows feel coming out around the country. All the programs, you're getting great people. So what was the evolution there for the young people? And as you answer this question, don't just gloss over what you're looking for in these people by saying the best people. Like, what is it, your secret sauce that you're looking for in associates? Because I'm sure that you're democratizing that as well across your practices. Like, what are the fundamental features that RCA is looking for in an associate?
You know, I think, let me step back. So I as a fellow, or even anybody coming into med school, you spend all this time and you've been told you're going to be a doctor, and you're going to do great things and you're going to help people. But then you really know nothing about business, and you know nothing because they don't teach you anything about business, right? You only sort of know what they hear now in these chat rooms of fellow or potential fellows and fellow applicants and the med school applicants. And I think it's very tough. And I think people need to step back first and figure out, what do you want in life, right? I can tell you that for most people, the most important thing is, I don't mean to be sexist, but there's a Texas saying, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. In other words, if your significant other, whether it be a guy or a girl or straight or gay or whatever, if they're not happy and you're happy all day at work and you come home and they're not happy, you're not going to be happy. Right. So the first thing is to figure out where your family or structure is going to wants to live. Do you want to live near your mom and dad? Do you want to live? Typically, you want to live near your significant other's mom and dad, or not too close, but not so far away that they think you're living in the wrong place. But and then the second thing you want to figure out is once you figure that out, I think that's the most important thing. Second most important thing is, what really do you like about what you do? Do you really like to see patients? Do you really like to do bench research? Do you really want to teach? Do you want to run your own business? Do you want to try to get in the Retina Society and, you know, hang out with people like Steve Schwartz and Mark Blumenkrantz? And or do you really, really want to be a community retina doctor and you want to make sure it's super important to be at Little League every time you can. But do you never want to go travel and do all these meetings, or do you? And then figure out which groups can you do that in. And I think it's very different. I think there are universities that you don't ever see their hires ever again. You know, whether they're staying at home with their family, or whether they're not allowed to publish, or whether they don't have enough research to publish. On the other hand, there are university settings where you see all the junior faculty, like Baskin-Palmer, like, you know, that kind of thing. The same thing with private groups. I mean, there are some private groups you've never heard of anybody in the group, and you've never seen any of them in a meeting for 1,000 years. Most of those are 100% productivity, where if you leave, your partner doesn't want to see your patients because they're all worried about making their own money. Right?
So there's a big spectrum of what people can choose from.
Yeah.
But that doesn't stop the fact that 5 or 10 years ago, and I'm just making up a number, the fellows were really anxious about joining private equity because they felt like they were economically capped. And so how did you get around that? Because obviously you've got some of the best docs in the country. What percentage of retina specialists in America work for RCA now?
You know, that's a very difficult question, because if you look at the ASRS, there's 3,300 retina specialists, but how many of those are truly surgical retina and or predominantly retina? I don't think anybody really knows. You know, I think that there's 110 fellows come out a year. You know, we hire about 30 of them last year. So I guess we're getting close to a third of the classes coming out, but we're not near a third of that 3,300.
Well, that 3,000 is a make-believe number, I think. And so what was it? So you're looking for, besides the quality of the program, smart, high integrity people, are you looking for a certain motor? Are you looking for a certain drive, something to prove? Or are you calculating that they actually know what they want to do?
No, I, to be honest, I think the most important thing is the thing I said that they ought to look for. I want to make sure that they're going to be happy in Houston, Texas. Right. And I may not know for sure. Charlie Wyckoff had never been to Texas. Right. I convinced him because of the research, and, you know, he got his family wrapped around it. He loves Houston. Right. But he'd never, ever been there. He's from Northern California. Most of the time, that's not going to work out. Most of the time, you're going to want somebody who comes back to an area where they're used to. Or
Charlie's a special case, though. He's got a special wife and a special family, and he's he's an exceptional exception to the rule in every way. And by that, I mean above everything.
No, he's superstar. I love Charlie. And then I think the next thing is, do I think that they'll be happy in the system that we're taking them? You know what I mean? In terms of, like, when I interview people, I like to see what really would make you happy, and what functions your goals. Like Patrick Steripoli. I don't know if you know Patrick, but Patrick is a kid who was a Baskin-Palmer fellow, and I know a bunch of the Baskin guys, and that's how I got acquainted with him. But Patrick came from a family of Italian immigrants. None of his family had ever been to college. And his dad was a race car driver, stock car driver, who had a crash. And he saw his dad in the hospital and kind of thought he might want to be a doctor. But his parents said, look, if you, and he raced go-karts and he was really good. And his parents said, if you make straight A's, we'll keep buying your go-karts. So the kid was the top of all his school classes in Central Florida and the best go-kart rider. And then he raced some NASCAR in high school and won this talent search and actually won a NASCAR race. And then he went to Harvard, and in between Harvard and Bascom Palmer, he was the pink race car driver for AutoNation for breast cancer. And so I'm interviewing him, and he raced some as a resident fellow, but it's hard to do. And he goes, you know, I really like being a doctor. I literally like being a retina surgeon, but I really like racing. And I go, let's do it. Let's find you sponsors. So he's our junior partner. And we helped him get some, you know, philanthropic sponsors. And he and Talladega, there's three races on the Saturday. He was in second place most of the race, ended up 11th. He races 10 times a year, but he's also a great retina surgeon. That's what makes him happy. If you can do that wherever, and that happy may be, you know, I want my kid to play world-class soccer, and this is the town that has it, right? I think you have to figure out what motivates people, makes them happy, because then they're going to be better at work. They're going to be better at life. I honestly really like people that like research. I like people that like to write papers. I like people that like to go to Arvo. Does everybody in my group have to do that? No. But when I'm recruiting you, I really like that, right?
So that's the Houston formula. You guys aren't sharing or imparting to your other practices in RCA what they should be looking for. You're letting everybody do their thing, right?
See who's going to be happy in your milieu, right?
Right.
That's great. And be a long-term partner and help work together as a team, right?
Just like, and Ricky Bobby's happy in your practice.
He's the rep, you know, if you're not first, you're last.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's just change the subject for a second, because a lot of people really admired the fact that you and Webster, you guys sold the second tranche. And can you talk to us about that a little bit, or is it still too sensitive?
No. I can. So, you know, we never thought we'd grow as big as we did, right? I mean, we almost grew too big. Like, we were so big that, you know, another private equity company, we were really only talking to the Blackstones and the very high end private equity firms, because you can't buy something expecting to grow it and flip it if you're already great big. And so we never thought we would be with a strategic buyer, which is a distributor or a manufacturer. But at the end of the day, it was the distributors and manufacturers who ended up being the best potential partners. And what it's done for us is it's really given us so many resources that you wouldn't have had with private equity, because now you have, we're not going to sell again, right? You don't have to worry. If you're a junior guy coming in, you don't have to worry. They said Webster was good and they didn't tell you what to do. But, you know, what about your next buyer? Are they going to make us wear pink scrubs and work on Saturdays and tell you we got to sell whatever, right? Sell lots of Hydradex or something, right? And this is a lot more of a stable structure. Cencora, which used to be AmerisourceBergen, is Fortune 10. They're the 10th largest sales in the country. The in-house legal is better than anybody I've ever worked with. They don't just say no. They try to figure out a way to help us, you know, mitigate the good days and how you figure out financial hardship. They're really motivated for a long-term commitment, where we grow, where we continue to hire, where we continue to build our research. And it's been so far a great partnership. It is a great big company, and it's way slower on most processes than I'm used to dealing with. There are big committees, but as a whole, they've been fantastic. Bob Mauch, CEO, I can call him anytime. I'm on the board along with Joel Perlman, that runs the subsidiary of RCA Cencora. They've stayed out of our knitting. They're not telling us what to do. So far, it's been extremely positive. I never knew there was a town called Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. That's their headquarters outside of Philly. I now know that, and I've been there a bunch.
That's really fantastic. And, you know, Dave, so here you are, rural Texas, wanted to be a chair, thought you were going to be a cardiovascular surgeon. Academia didn't, the Red Sea didn't part for you, and you went and did your own thing, and you prioritized your family, which is always a smart move, and grew your Houston Retina Associates to Retina Consultants of Texas to Retina Consultants of America, and now you're one of the leaders, if not the leader, of the biggest group of retina docs in the world. It's not even close. And arguably the best. And so massive congratulations to you on that. And I would invite any of our listeners to write to Dr. Brown, reach out to Dr. Brown. He's extremely affable and kind and loves to meet people and share his story. Before you go, I just want to talk about some of my favorite research that you've done, and maybe you can share a story about it. One of my favorite projects that you worked on was the OCTs in space. So talk to us a little bit about being the NASA retina doc and what that was like and how hard you had to push back to not get sent up in the space shuttle to tune the OCT.
Yeah, so I'm you know, Houston's put a man on the moon. Lyndon Johnson put the Space Center here, another great Texan. You know, the astronauts are amazing. They work their whole lives to get shot in a rocket, which amazingly almost always they come back from. And they knew forever that whenever you got sent into space that your eye changed pretty quickly. And you got this hyperopic shift, and literally all the way back to Gus Grissom and such. After that, once you were there a few days, you got sent up in space with what they call your space glasses. And they were your refraction plus a half, and then plus one, and then plus one and a half. And the longer you're up in space, you just kept changing glasses. And they didn't know why. So after a while, some people came down with what appeared to be disc edema and or choroidal folds, and they didn't go away. So they were trying to figure out what the change was in space. And they got, because it looked like intracranial hypertension, they convened like the 20 most famous neuro-ophthalmologists in the world. And they had this big brain think tank, and they thought, well, you know, we ought to put an OCT into space. That wasn't my idea. It was a great idea, but it wasn't my idea. And then they trained the astronauts, and they did Heidelberg OCTs before, during, after. And they're neuro-ophthalmologists. And if you're just a carpenter, you only see hammers and nails. And so they did, I'm not kidding, probably 30 different scan protocols. Only one, 29 were through the nerve. Only one went through the fovea, right? And so they'd never really had a retina guy look at the OCTs. And I took care of the astronauts for the problems. I'm a Houston retina guy, and I get sent, you know, both the executives and astronauts. And so they said, would you mind looking at all these OCTs? And I go, okay. And it was a big political thing and took like a year to be able to go in. And then under secrecy, I go in and review all these Heidelberg tract OCTs. And I see that the choroid's getting thicker on everybody. And that before this, they thought that only some people had the problem, which was called SANS, space-associated neuro-ophthalmic syndrome. It was called neuro-ophthalmic syndrome because only neuro-ophthalmologists had ever looked at it, but that's a different story. And so it turns out that it wasn't just some people had SANS, 100% of them had prelaminar disc edema and had encroachment of the cup in. And so that led to changing the protocols to where we have more choroidal scanning. Got my good buddy Rick Spade involved. I think he's correct. I think it's venous overload choroidopathy. I think because normally your blood flow drains down because of gravity. You don't have that in space. So their heads get puffy when you talk to them on Zoom. And without that, you get increased choroidal pressure that get that choroidal thickening. That's what causes that mild choroidal edema. My biggest concern, and it hasn't happened yet, is that some of these people are very likely to get anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, as they're getting congestion of that anterior optic nerve head. If that happens on a Mars mission 3 years in, it wouldn't be great, right? So ideally, we figure out ways to mitigate or at least predict who's going to get it. At this point, all we can say is that your biggest protective mechanism is to have a big cup going up, because you got so much more space as that encloses in, right?
So why the hyperopia? Is it because the choroid's moving the macula forward?
No, I think it's just choroidal congestion. I think your vortex veins are getting increased venous. You're getting venous backflow, and sure.
I didn't realize. I guess what I'm saying is I didn't realize that hyperopia was a part of that.
Yeah, it's because your choroid gets thicker and you actually get more hyperopic. And you get fat globe.
But is it because you're moving forward like you do in CSR? Your macula is moving forward in the eye? Yeah. That's what it is. That's what I was asking.
While your eye's moving forward.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
It flattens, right?
Right.
And right. So it's a fascinating problem, and we've got more and more data. What I've seen post-flight, and the ones I've done ICGs, is I see vortex vein anastomosis like Spade has shown with CSC. But a lot of them could have CSC, right? They're previous fighter pilots and stuff like that, right? And so what we're working on now is, can we get choroidal imaging either from like the Dream OCT, the 4,000 kilohertz, or ICG them before? Well, if we can show that there are no choroidal venous anastomosis in some people before space and afterwards it is, that'll answer why the choroidal thickens, why it stays thickened, why they have some pre-laminar. It won't solve the problem, but we're getting more towards defining what this issue is so that we can potentially mitigate or at least figure out who's at highest risk. It's fun.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And so I'm wondering, solution-wise, have you guys seen it resolve at all with exercise or exposure to different G-forces, or it just sits there?
Not really. I mean, you could maybe hang people from their feet or something, spin them around like I don't know.
Right, yeah.
So the Russians, so we see, I see a lot of the SpaceX.
We share a lot of those guys, yeah. You and I have shared a lot of the SpaceX people, and
they're not up long enough.
No, and they don't have that sort of experience.
Yeah, they get some changes, but they're not up long enough. One of the funnest stories is that because of the cephalocaudal blood supply issue, the Russians don't wear shock trousers, but they wear these tight pants, which are supposed to increase the venous pressure. And the Russians claim they've never seen any changes in their cosmonauts in space. Of course, they don't dope their athletes, and they
haven't looked with an OCT. So
they probably haven't looked with an OCT.
Right. That's right. Well, Dave, thank you very much for taking this time to chat with us. Retina Rounds has a really eclectic, widespread global audience, and you are clearly one of the giants in retina. You've been so innovative, and you've disrupted what was a pretty stagnant practice pattern and created a whole new silo for our specialty, and you're lapping the field. So we just want to say congratulations and thanks for taking the time, and keep up the good work, my friend. We're also proud of you.
No problem. Good. Like I said, it's a big team. Certainly couldn't do any of this without my research coordinators, people like Charlie Wyckoff, Ankur Shah, Joel Perlman. It takes a big team, and it takes people that want to work together and help fight a mission together. And so, yeah, I'm at the tip of the spear sometimes, but it's a big army behind me. So.
Well, you got to be brave, and it's a combination of being fearless and having vision. And there's a lot of leadership involved. Everybody's got an opinion, and to get everybody aligned towards a common goal is a really special gift. And I think you've made a giant impact. So thank you very, very much for joining us.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.